Hello, everybody, and welcome to Conversations in Lung Cancer Research, a TOGA podcast. My name's Mel Moore. I'm a medical oncologist at St Vincent's in Melbourne. I'd like to start by, on behalf of TOGA, acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we live and work. We pay our respect to their elders past, present and emerging. We also extend that respect to all Indigenous people. Now, on today's podcast, it's my pleasure to welcome Professor Shankar Seva. Shankar is a radiation oncologist at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre in Melbourne, and he leads the Stereotactive Ablative Body Radiotherapy, or SABR, program at Peter Mac. He's internationally recognised for his work in high-technology radiotherapy delivery. He has designed and led five international investigator-initiated clinical trials through TROG, and has over 300 peer-reviewed publications. More recently, he has received $1.5 million for funding for the PRIME Lung study, which we will talk about during this conversation. I'd like to welcome Shankar to TOGA's Conversations in Lung Cancer Research podcast.
Thank you so much, Melissa. I'm really glad to be here, and I'm glad to have a chat with you this afternoon.
So as we mentioned in the intro, Shankar, congratulations on the grant. I believe it was an MRFF grant for PRIME Lung.
I'm very excited about that. Just recently announced the lifted embargo. I'm quite keen to be working with TOGA and the TOGA investigators on this study. So this is a study that's looking at patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, so stage four, without activating driver mutations or targetable therapies. So this is your garden variety non-small cell lung cancer, the more common one. And in this setting, we're investigating the approach of adding radiotherapy to the primary tumor alone, in addition to systemic therapy. So this is a planned 420 patient phase 3 randomized control trial, which we're hoping to commence next year with the idea of enrolling patients in Australia, with collaborators also in Ireland and in Canada. So the study itself is something that's kind of homegrown and developed from the ground up, and really keen to lead this in a multi-center setting across a few nations.
So Shankar, is there any earlier work that you've built on to take this to a big trial like this?
In looking back on it, I can already see the old template that we applied to ALTG and at that time, which is a 2020 kind of application. So the idea has been bubbling around in the head for a long time. It's actually borrowed a little bit from other cancers, because there are other cancers such as prostate cancer, nasopharyngeal cancer and breast cancer that have shown a benefit from adding radiotherapy to the primary. It's really a borrowed idea from other malignancies to be applying this in the non-small cell lung cancer space. And interestingly enough, more recently, there's been a couple of randomized control trials, three in fact, that have shown the same kind of benefit from an overall survival benefit perspective in patients with actionable driver mutated EGFR mutations in non-small cell lung cancer. So this is a perfect niche to be able to test the idea. It's got some nice data in other cancers. And we ourselves have tried to assess the idea in a pilot study, which has led towards the grant application itself. So we're just about to finish our pilot study, of a randomized pilot study of 40 patients across three centers, and really was looking at safety of the addition of radiation in this context. And we're really happy that it's a safe combination and we can deliver moderate doses of radiation alongside chemoimmunotherapy in patients who are receiving these standard of care systemic therapies.
So Shankar, could you elaborate a bit more on, I guess, the practicalities of going from a concept in your head to a large trial like this?
It's a drawn-out process, I can say that. But part of it comes from, talking to your colleagues. So I am very invested with my medical oncology colleagues in this study, because this is a patient population as a radiation oncologist that I don't get to see very often, unless it's a very targeted type of consultations about palliating some symptoms. So this is not the cohort that I would normally see. So this really requires multidisciplinary input and collaboration with medical oncologists, and really understanding whether they also see there's a potential advantage in testing this question. And so it took a bit of, water cooler chats and coffee rounds, and even then talking at ALTG/TOGA now at that time to float the idea. And from there, it's been a progress from there to get the study to through TROG as well, the Trans-Tasman Radiation Oncology Group. So this is going to be a multi-organization type study. Interestingly, we piggybacked this also from a very interesting registry. It's called the Aurora Registry that I think Toga is very familiar with, that is going to form the backbone of some of the data collection. So it's meant to make it quite lean and quite pragmatic as well. So taking it from a concept, then flagging it with multiple different parties to try to take it to beyond the concept to actually a grant proposal. Part of the feedback we had early is that even though we can see that radiotherapy is used as a standard of care and in non-small cell lung cancer, maybe we needed some pilot data to test the feasibility. So we did that to make sure it's feasible to randomize patients like this, whether the clinicians and patients would be willing to be randomized, and also the safety of this kind of combination. And those have all been very reassuring. And it's led to a grant application for MRFF as of last year, which was lucky. It was 1 out of 1 to get it. We also did apply for a couple of the grants because they were a bit slow to get back to us. It still worked out in the end, and it does take a lot of legwork to get to that point with a successful grant application to move forward.
And how did the international collaborations come about?
That's also just floating the idea. So the international collaborations often just happen maybe at a conference or perhaps at a different meeting forum where an individual might be in the country in Australia, for example, where you float the idea and they seem interested. This has come about from two different groups, the Irish Cancer Trials Group and CAPRI, which is a Canadian Pulmonary Radiation Oncology Investigator Group. And there was just some key collaborators and colleagues over there that were quite interested in the idea. So we sent them the protocol and the concept, and they were part of the MRFF application. And the idea is that they're going to jump on board and contribute approximately about a third of the patients into the total study design. But it is heavy lifting, and they need to put in some work as well on their end. So it takes a lot of motivation from an investigator-initiated study to get it off the ground and even to the starting line.
Sounds like it's been a huge amount of work on your part, Shankar, and other team members as well. So congratulations again. That's a fantastic study, and we'll be very excited to see the outcome of that. Just want to move a little bit more generally just about you alluded to grant applications and some of the, you know, we all are aware of success rates for especially big MRFF grants. What are some of the practical tips that you'd offer for clinician researchers that are got the clinical load, wanting to do some research, wanting to do some investigator-initiated research, but in also mindful of the low success rates with grant applications? Any tips or practical points?
The practical points, there's a lot of advice from the universities and other groups that can probably assist on the practical grant writing components. For me, I think some of the more gestalt of writing grants, I think when you have an idea, it's really important that everybody finds it controversial and nobody likes it, because often you're onto a winner there if everyone seems like they have their own view on the particular topic, even though there isn't any evidence. So even, for example, for Prime Lung, it was very clear from the outset that it was a controversial idea and people had their view whether or not it's a no-brainer or whether it should even be tested at all. So the idea of, you know, radiation to the primary in non-small cell lung cancer, it's a novel area when you're thinking about patients who don't potentially need radiotherapy in the classic sense. So the idea is important. It needs to be road tested and floated amongst colleagues. And once you're happy that the idea is robust, part of the grant application process and even getting the idea amongst your colleagues is a bit of compromise. So we have to be aware that there's going to be some compromise just to bring people on board with their idea and then subsequently the grant application. Keeping a team relatively tight and with trusted collaborators is really important. I think nothing is worse than working with people you don't like or people who are particularly difficult, because there's no point in doing that. You might as well have fun with your collaborators, and this is all for your own interest and making furthering the science and helping people in the future. If you're not having fun doing it, it's probably not worth the effort. From the grant proposal perspective, you're right. It's like the success rates are exceedingly low and they're getting harder and harder to do these trials. Sometimes from a grant perspective, it's partly starting small and working upwards. Even for Prime Lung, for example, I mentioned it's a 2020 concept, but it was always a 420 patient randomized phase 3 trial even back then. But it's kind of taken the steps of doing a pilot study, of getting the processes in place, making minor tweaks to the protocol along the way. That is part of the journey. So that time is not being wasted necessarily. And, you know, we only really started going for the big grant applications more recently. We did talk to industry early on. But the big grant applications were probably in the last year or so. But that time period was building the data, building some of the feasibility. We did feasibility assessments amongst both the TROG and the TOGA membership. And these are all steps, you know, proposing this at TOGA, for example, making sure you get feedback from the membership. That was key because the membership are going to be the recruiters in this case. So medical oncology is a key component. And if, you know, your craft group didn't like the study idea, then there's no point in doing it. So floating it amongst the craft group is really, really important. And taking a small grant, a small feasibility pilot application, small number of dollars to be able to get those first runs on the board is a nice manageable step to a larger study, because I think it's very difficult to bite off the full phase 3 randomized trial in one step, and it may need a few little steps to get there.
Can I clarify, Shankar, that you said at the start of that if an idea is seen as controversial, that's almost a good thing. That must be quite hard, though, when you've got peers or other experts, you know, potentially thinking your idea doesn't have legs, to then hold to your convictions and push through with that.
Yes, and it's trying to balance the crazy out there idea, which is just universally controversial, versus something that might make a huge difference, but it is out of the box. So often, for me personally, and reflection, I like the out of the box ideas because they are often controversial, but they have the potential to create great impact. I think a lot of studies that are less interesting can be Me Too type studies where you're substituting drug X for drug Y and similar class, and that's may not be as interesting as trying to go out there and try something in a different space that has a high likelihood of not working, but still, if it does make an impact, it can change a paradigm of the way we treat. So from a purely clinical point of view, I think the ideas that cause a bit of controversy are a good one.
Interesting. You mentioned options of industry funding. I know in medical oncology trials where you've got a drug to administer, that's probably an obvious link. But in radiation oncology, how does industry come into funding RANOC trials?
In radiation oncology, research funding is more challenging than it is in medical oncology. I think the budgets are much greater with industry-based trials in the pharmaceutical space. The way that we would approach it still in this setting was the idea that perhaps the radiation therapy is a mechanism to prolong the efficacy of the systemic therapy or improve the efficacy of the systemic therapy as an adjunct rather than a replacement. In radiation trials that are funded by industry, it's a bit different. We tend to do things that are more technically based, but they're smaller and probably more compact type trial designs than phase 3 trials with an overall survival endpoint. With industry, it's a challenging one because the field moves really quickly too, and to try to pick the right spot and the right pick the eyes out of the question is more of a challenge. And particularly as agents change and the standard of care changes, I've been victim to that for a couple of different trials. For example, trying to combine immunotherapy and radiation in the non-small cell lung cancer space, where the standard of the care changed with immunotherapy. One of them is the former ALTG TROG NIVORAD study, where we're combining SABR with second line nivolumab in non-small cell lung cancer, and basically the standard of care changed, and there was no longer a population we could recruit to. And same with pembrolizumab, we did that a similar study in that from a non-small cell lung cancer space of Peter Mac. So trying to figure out the actual sweet spot for investigator-initiated industry studies is challenging. There's often a cap on what's available. So typically when you're doing those types of approaches, my understanding is the best thing is have a very small, compact phase 1, phase 2 type of approach that can generate new data relatively quickly, and hopefully they can come up with the next big idea. The issues of how to translate that into a investigator-initiated phase 3, that's a lot more challenging, even with industry support. And often the most interesting questions we can answer from a collaborative group point of view are not the questions that industry want answered. And this may mean that you do a little bit of industry partnership and maybe some competitive grant funding, but I think they're still the most important questions that we'd like to answer.
Shankar, we've been talking about your involvement with lung cancer, but you also have an interest in genitourinary cancers. How did that actually come about for you? Was that just what you were required to do at the time that you started your work as a consultant, or was there another particular interest in that area?
So actually it was partly mentorship. Someone you know, Melissa, is Vasha Frudi, who is one of my mentors at Peter Mac, and he kind of saw what I was doing in the lung space and kind of invited me to have a look and have a sticky peek around the GU space. And that's how it started pretty much about 2011, 2012. So since that time, though, I can see a lot of interesting corollaries and interesting ideas that we can borrow from both spaces. So I mentioned to you before, prime lung was borrowing from other cancers. Actually, this is very, very similar to the prostate stampede cohort H study, which is basically adding radiotherapy to the prostate in patients with low volume metastatic disease, which has now become a standard of care. So that's an idea that I borrowed directly, you know, blueprint, copy, cut, paste, find, replace prostate with lung into the lung cancer space. And of course, there's some other trials also in different malignancies also showing the same benefit. But really, it's an idea that I was in that same framework and kind of borrowed to come into the lung space. From a GU perspective, it's also very interesting because technology is really important and new techniques in the GU space. And it's come across that the fact, the timing around SABR and stereotactic radiotherapy was really a good, fortunate coincidence that moving into some interest in the GU space has become really prominent over the last decade.
I guess I'm aware of what you might say here, but just for our listeners, is there a particular project or a trial in the genitourinary space that you've been involved with that you've been particularly proud of?
Yeah, there's a couple. So I think what's really interesting for me and was really rewarding was back in 2014, we started a trial called POPSTAR, which is basically a pilot study of patients with oligometastatic prostate cancer, which is treated with stereotactic ablative radiotherapy. So this is something that we used oligometastasis a decade ago, was very controversial in prostate cancer, and it was becoming evident because we started using PET scans in that space. And the idea is whether we could help patients do better with local ablative therapies like SABR. So we did this initial pilot study and then it progressed and we had some really nice findings that we published in 2018 in European Urology. And then from there, it's developed into POPSTAR 2, which we're currently recruiting to at the moment, which is a randomization between SABR for oligometastatic prostate cancer with or without theranostics, so lutetium PSMA. Really novel, a randomized phase 2 trial, a multi-center trial, and it's something that hopefully we're going to get some outcomes to like perhaps later next year. But it shows how it's kind of an evolution of progression and mindset of where when I started, that idea was shouted upon that oligometastasis doesn't exist in prostate cancer and what are you doing trying to ablate these spots? Now we're really wrestling with whether we should be using hormone therapy in these patients at all, whether we should be escalating with other multiple drug pathways and androgen receptor pathways, or even escalating with lutetium. So it's really changed the way that we're looking at things.
You mentioned STAMPEDE trial and radiation in prostate cancer. Apart from that, where do you see the next big shift in radiation therapy for GU cancers?
Well, I might be a little bit biased, but I think kidney cancer is one space that we're really, really interested in now because originally, and at least when I was training, it was thought that kidney cancer was radio resistant and we don't use radiation treatment for renal cell carcinoma. We just published, I think last year in the Lancet Oncology in 2024, the Trans-Tasman Radio Oncology Group TROGS Fast Track 2 trial, which was a multi-center phase 2 trial of patients receiving SABR for primary kidney cancer and had really, really excellent kind of unprecedented results, 100% local control and over 95% or 100% cancer-specific survival. So it was really interesting modality for using for patients who may have cancers that either the patient or declined surgery or they were at high risk of surgery. And this has opened up a new field for us in radiation oncology. Now we're seeing more patients who may be eligible for these type of treatments, particularly ones who may not have had great local curative treatment options before. So even in our institution, which is a relatively mature SABR institution, we've been treating primary kidney cancer since 2012. The number of patients coming through from that indication has really accelerated over the last 2 years. And I'm seeing this globally as well. So for us, I think kidney cancer is the next big field for GU oncology and radiation.
So I guess that's another good example of something that's controversial that's turned out to potentially be practice changing.
Exactly. At least I think so.
So Shankar, you're clearly an internationally recognized expert on SABR. What sparked your interest or how did you get into SABR, I guess, for want of a better phrase?
Yeah, so it's a very, very simple and fortuitous, I guess. There was a visiting professor, Jim Heyman, who came from Mayo Clinic in Rochester in 2009 when I was doing a rotation with Professor David Ball, who is my main mentor in my career, who's recently retired and the head of the lung unit at Peter Mac. He was visiting and we were talking about a trial that David was about to open called the Chisel trial, which was a study that was comparing conventional radiotherapy to SABR in early stage non-small cell lung cancer. So, you know, we talk about SABR being pretty common and ubiquitous in treating early stage inoperable lung cancer, but it was really at that time a new concept, at least in the Australian setting. And this study was comparing our standard six-week course of radiotherapy to this SABR approach over three treatments for primary lung cancer. So I asked the question, you know, why aren't we doing this for oligometastatic disease? And Professor Heyman was like, yeah, we are doing this elsewhere. And so that was kind of came part about the reason for the interest into looking at pulmonary oligometastasis. And I wrote a little protocol and a systematic review with Professor David Ball. And the idea was just to run a 10-patient pilot study testing this very focused SABR treatment in oligometastatic disease. And eventually that became the SAFFRON-2 trial, which is a randomized trial across TROG that we ran from 2012 to 2015. David Ball really gave me the keys to the kingdom in a sense, because he wanted to start a more dedicated kind of SABR service at Peter Mac. And around about 2012, when I was starting my PhD, he gave me the backing and gave me the confidence, I guess, to start a program and a particular service that was brand new at Peter Mac, which is dedicated to stereotactic body radiotherapy. It was controversial. There was a lot of people, in fact, my colleagues from radiation oncology were sometimes a bit conservative, a bit reluctant. And also it was a different process. Now, we were very tumor stream based, and all of a sudden we had this cross tumor stream type service that was potentially threatening and potentially challenging in some areas. And some groups embraced it, some groups maybe found it a bit threatening. And certainly it was an eye-opening experience for me, being very naive. But I think that was the main catalyst for moving forward, like David Ball's mentorship and belief into that space. And from there, he really just did foster an environment where I was able to grow clinical trial ideas and grow technical ideas. And along the way, I've replicated that among some of my mentees along the way as well, and a few of my PhD students that have come across, and hopefully that they have got the experience and the, I guess, confidence to be able to move forward into future trials as well.
I think one of the things that has come out consistently with this series of podcasts is just how important mentorship has been to everybody's careers, and, you know, and how positive everyone is to pay that forward as well to the next cohort coming through. So you mentioned just some, I guess, more political barriers to getting this up and running. Were there any practical obstacles you had to overcome in terms of expertise, machinery, that sort of thing, to get this service going?
Yeah, it's a very good point. We had a lot of limitations on machine time as well. We're a very busy department. And so this made it challenging to be able to schedule patients who needed longer than standard treatment slots and fewer treatments than standard. So it's very easy to schedule a patient for 6 weeks when you know they come back in every day and, you know, can dedicate that machine to that time. But having ad hoc and sporadic appointments that may only be one session, but it takes an hour, is a difficult thing to schedule. So there were some limitations on coordinating that. And importantly, it's a very multidisciplinary approach. So we had our physicists and our radiation technologists, the radiotherapists involved as well. It's a very multidisciplinary environment to be able to deliver. So it's not just the radoncs who are being able to prescribe and just do these treatments. It needs everybody on board from a radiation perspective to execute. So there was some of the technical limitations. There was the indications too. So it was a new and developing field, and there were some indications that were better established, like in lung cancer, and then there's some brand new indications that we were just developing. So we were very careful to make sure that we tried to do this via trials. So trying to make sure we recruited patients as to many prospective trials as we could. If we couldn't do that, we had every patient on a prospective registry, and we set up a very specific way of quality assurance. So every patient at Peter Mac had a single quality assurance round where we all looked at it as peer reviewed amongst multiple radiation oncologists, physicists, and radiotherapists as well, the technologists who were able to peer review each case. And it's still the case today, like every case gets peer reviewed, even though the volume is much higher than it was before. We know we're treating over 400 patients a year, but it still has a very high quality control perspective. So setting all that up early takes a lot of legwork, but it's worth it in the long run because we were able to produce quite high quality data from our institution, but this has given us a leg up to be able to move forward into prospective clinical trials.
So Shank, I just wanted to finish up by asking you, there's potentially people that will be listening to this, junior radiation oncologists, radiation oncology registrars, that thinking, wow, you know, that sounds like an amazing career, an amazing interest in research, but maybe seems a long way away and not sure where to start and may not work in a big cancer-specific center either. Do you have any advice for junior colleagues who would like to emulate what you're doing and how they would start to go about that?
I think a lot of it has to do with taking it one bite at a time, to be honest. So it's very difficult to tackle an entire piece of work and take it all with one swallow. It's better to take just cut little pieces off and bite it off. So that means when you're applying for grants, don't go for the MRFF straight away. Like try smaller little bits, little pockets of 10,000, 20,000, whatever it takes to get a small project off the ground. Try and say yes to opportunities for editorials or for reviewing a paper if someone asks you to do that. Say yes to a few things. Sometimes we can become a bit more transactional in this day and age. You know, what is it in it for me? But often when you're asked to do something, it may be without a specific goal or objective or outcome at the end of it, but with the faith that if you do a good job, maybe that's going to help in the future with either an opportunity that might come down the track. And certainly you have to be open-minded in that context and get involved as much as you can. So for example, you know, TOGA is a great environment. TROG is also a great environment. If there are other areas to just be present and be available and enjoy the ideas around it, that will be helpful. Part of it's also, I think you have to kind of treat it like a hobby. There's no point in doing this kind of scientific involvement if you're not having fun, if you're finding it a chore. Gamify it if you need to, like just have some small goals or, you know, try to make sure you, even if it's having a beer with your colleagues or your mentors in different disciplines, I think that's really important. And try not to look at the end game. I'm still not sure what my end game is. Like I've just ticked over into mid-career now. So I don't know what the exact end game is, but I still got a few more years left in it. So I just taking, you know, the view that I don't necessarily have a 5-year win objective and idea of where I want to be at that time. If I can be doing similar things to what I'm doing now and still enjoying it, I'll be very, very happy. And the idea is that intellectual curiosity, it's just to feed it a little bit here and there. The grant rejections is a real thing, and that still happens to me a lot. So I think you have to wear that, unfortunately. Be aware that that's the name of the game. Don't take it personally, dust yourself off. And when you do get a little win, no matter how small it is, enjoy it, because this game, you know, in science is very short-lived in terms of the amount of effort you put in, and it's very easy to get a success and then just glance over it and move on to your next project. But try to enjoy it because, you know, and it's something I need to teach myself to do a bit better, is to just, you know, enjoy the wins along the way as well.
Shank, it's been a pleasure watching your successes. I think we were both fairly junior consultants in the early Friday morning urology MGM at St. Vincent's. And since then, you've really come on in leaps and bounds and been doing some groundbreaking research. Really lovely to hear about what's next for you, about some of your wisdom and experience and advice for the next generation of radiation oncologists. So you've done a remarkable amount of work for being mid-career and look forward to seeing what's ahead.
Thanks so much, Mel. And yeah, it's been really enjoyable, and I hope to work with my medical oncology colleagues more closely in TOGA and beyond.
Look forward to it, Shankar. That brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you to Shankar for joining us today. And as always, thank you for listening to TOGA's Conversations in Lung Cancer Research. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And look forward to joining you next time.